G'day everybody, welcome back to The Bird Is God for another fortnight. You might be able to tell, or you will soon, that I'm not in my office with my normal recording gear. I think the last time I did that was potentially the last episode, so that's interesting. There might be all sorts of stuff going on around me. My wife and I decided a couple days ago with 24 hours notice that we were going to take our kids on a 4-day holiday to Kangaroo Island, so currently, I'm sitting on the deck of our holiday house in Vivon Bay. It's not our holiday house, but Airbnb, Vivon Bay, which is pretty fantastic. But that also means that there might be some of my kids making noise in the background or cars driving past or whatever. So hopefully it all works out all right. We're in a very nice little holiday house here. I'm just looking out over a very large expanse of scrubland, and I can see the Harriet River in front of me, and then the beach is, I can hear it, it's about a kilometre to the left. So since I've been sitting here for probably the last 5 or 10 minutes, I've seen or heard little ravens, pied currawongs, rainbow lorikeets, purple-gaped honeyeaters, red wattlebirds, New Holland honeyeaters, you can probably hear some silver gulls in the background. One grey fantail came and sat on the railing, and an Australian magpie, and there's some martins flying around, but I can't tell you whether they're tree or fairy. One thing I didn't plan on was not having any Wi-Fi or phone reception, which is neither here nor there to me personally, but it does make uploading this episode very difficult, so I haven't decided how I'm going to get around that. If this comes out Monday morning, then you will know that I waited until I got home. So, we haven't really done any birding yet. We only got here yesterday afternoon, and possibly won't do very much. This holiday is very much a small child-friendly holiday. I don't know if I've mentioned it on a podcast before, but I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old and a 9-month-old. So, they're not quite up to huge, big, long bush walks just yet. But we might have a look at a few places, easy to get to with prams, potentially. But no expectations, which is probably the best way to approach a holiday like this. The only other thing I was going to say is that with Christmas and New Year's coming up and everybody going away, or not wanting to be at work at least, I'm not going to be doing the next 2 podcast episodes. So the plan is for the next one to come out on January 29th. And if I do some before then I'll start earlier, but that's current plans. It's been a... Let's ignore the rest of the world and just focus on this one particular podcast. It's been a fantastic year. I've had a huge amount of fun talking to some fascinating people and learning all sorts of stuff. I've learned a lot about podcasting, and if I listen back to my first few episodes, it makes me cringe a little bit. But so sorry to the people I interviewed. You guys were fine. It's just my steep learning curve, but I'm hoping that I've more or less ironed most of that out. But I've had a fantastic year, and I just wanted to say thank you to everybody who has listened and who has contacted me. It's really great when people message me to say thanks for putting on the podcast, or have you thought about interviewing this person, or this is some thoughts on your last episode. So if you ever have any thoughts, feel free to get in touch. It's always fantastic. And a special thanks to everybody who has rated or reviewed my podcast on whatever platform you get yours through. That's always very helpful. And I'm pretty excited to see what 2021 brings, both in terms of what this podcast is going to look at and who we will chat to, just birding in general, I'm quite looking forward to, and at least some interstate travel around Australia, if not international, maybe the year after that. And finally, because I don't have any internet, I can't tell you what's been happening in birding circles around the place, so with that in mind, let's just get into today's conversation.
You're listening to The Birder's Guide with Michael Greenshields.
Do today on the show, we've got Adrian Boyle, who people may know. He's quite well known in birding circles around Australia. He's on a fair few of the same birding Facebook pages that I'm on, and he's been heavily involved with the Broome Bird Observatory, Shorebird counts, etc., etc. I came across his profile, which I didn't know at the time, but I was looking at jobs doing bird guiding, very not seriously, but just for interest's sake, doing bird guiding in Antarctica, and discovered that he was one of the people who work for one of the companies to do that. So I thought, well, there's an interesting bloke to chat to. So I got Adrian on, and we had a conversation earlier this week. I did think about halfway through the conversation that it might possibly be more related to international. I'm sorry, you can probably hear a whole bunch of kids hollering down as they try and hop into the river because it's freezing cold. I'm sitting here in jumper and track pants and they're going for a swim. So anyway, if you can hear them in the background, which I'm sure you can. Yep, sorry. Anyway, I thought that talking to Adrian might be more of like an international guest thing because Australia isn't. Antarctica, the vast majority, is technically not Australia, but he's Australian. We talked about a few other things as well, and I didn't have anybody else that I could put up today. So anyway, without any further ado, let's get into it. So Adrian, welcome to the Birder's Guide. Great to have you on the show.
Yeah, hello.
Now, you're based in Broome currently, I believe, but you didn't grow up in Broome, did you?
Yeah, that's correct. I grew up in the sunny southeast of South Australia, and I've been a keen bird watcher pretty much forever. Nothing really happened to make me a keen bird watcher. It just always been there. And basically, with a friend, we spotted some migratory shorebirds, a bird called a sanderling, which occur pretty much right the way around the coast of Australia. And they had these little tags on their legs. And I was a member of a few organisations, like BirdLife at the moment. And, contacted them and got hold of who the original banders were who had put these tags on to try and track their movements around Australia and through the what we call the East Asian Australasian flyway on their way to northern parts of China and Russia to breed. And just sort of got hooked on migratory shorebirds. And as some of the listeners will know, Broome is probably the best shorebird site in Australia just for diversity and numbers and ease of viewing. And, soon learnt that, you know, this was the spot to be. And I started coming up here regularly from 1994 up onwards, helping catch and tag and study migratory shorebirds, but moved here permanently after getting offered a job at the Broome Bird Observatory, which is an amazing place to view lots of birds, but particularly the migratory shorebirds.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's certainly, as you say, certainly one of the top, if not the top spot in Australia to see shorebirds. Why shorebirds in particular? Is it just fate that you happen to find some sanderlings that were tagged? Or, I mean, shorebirds, especially in Australia, are not the most colourful, vibrant species.
No, they're not, and a lot of people struggle with them. There's a lot of birds that look very similar. The other problem is that they change colour, so they go through a big transformation in plumages. They change their feathers or replace their feathers into breeding plumage and non-breeding plumage. So people might just start getting used to identifying them and next minute they start changing colour. And then in most places, but not all in Australia, the populations decline quite dramatically as all the adults head north to the breeding ground. So a lot of places in Australia, people just, you know, only see them for 4 or 5 months of the year and they become very confusing. But in Broome, we still have about 20,000 birds over winter, so even when the adults are north, we have the juveniles here. And so this, as we mentioned before, this is the place to be. And I don't think anything really took my interest with them you know, more than any other birds, apart from their migration and just the lack of, particularly in those early days, you know, the lack of understanding of, you know, how far these birds travel and the sites that they require to make that journey, to stop off. They don't do a big journey all the way to Russia in one flight. They do need to stop. So learning about those sites and hopefully protecting them was a key element.
When you were saying something about traveling to Siberia, I had someone out on a tour, what are we today, Monday, end of last week, and they asked me a question about shorebirds breeding. When shorebirds breed, do they, the young ones, the ones that have just hatched that year, do they also make that migration? Like, if they hatch in Siberia, it's pretty cold to survive if you're a young thing, but it's also a hell of a long way to fly if you're a young thing.
Yes, that's a good question. No, they all head further south because depending on the species and where you are breeding, they're going to those areas to exploit the amazing food resources that are there during the summer. So again, it does depend where you are in those areas, but in a lot of places, there's 24 hours of daylight. And of course, in the winter, there's 24 hours of darkness. So yeah, all the birds head further south, including the juveniles. Some species, males and females, do slightly different journeys as well. But as a whole, they all move further south, and some of them will, you know, stop off in southern parts of Asia or even, you know, northern China and Japan. It really depends on what species we're talking about. But a large majority head further south, you know, into places like Australia, including the juveniles. And there's, by the time they're starting to fly and head back, usually not necessarily with the adults. They often travel, the adults have often left a little bit earlier, particularly the females in most species. They're, once they've laid their eggs, their job's pretty much over. So they're some of the first to come back to Australia. But yeah, the juveniles will look different in plumage, but the size is pretty much the same. I don't go out in the field and go, wow, that's a small one. That's got to be a baby. There's plumage patterns will indicate that for me. But size, they're pretty much the same size. Obviously not when they hatch, but when they're flying back south, they're the same size.
I've heard, I've seen a lot of things written about you that call you a shorebird researcher. Are you an official researcher with an organisation, or is that just a title that people give you?
Yeah, I guess less and less, you know, these days I'm doing research. Unfortunately, you know, as you know, with money and environmental projects, there's not a lot of money getting thrown around these days. So unfortunately, I'm doing a little bit less shorebird research than what I was doing years ago. I'm mainly into tourism and guiding. But for at least 2 months of the year, I spend time in China helping a colleague, Chris Hassel, who's a full-time shorebird researcher in Roebuck Bay, looking at survival rates on four particular migratory shorebirds. And I used to help him and still do help him when I'm in town. But yeah, I spend 2 months of the year in China with Chris looking for bands and tags that we've placed on those birds, trying to look at their survival rates. So yes, I still do study migratory shorebirds, but not as much as what I used to.
I saw a photo of you on your Facebook page in the middle of a huge, great big mud flat, which I cannot think of anywhere in Australia that would be. So I'm going to assume that it was in China, which was, I think, June last year that you put the photo up. Is there, you know, what's some of the best places that you've been for looking at shorebirds?
Yeah, I can't visualise that image. I've probably got a few. But when you say large mud flat, I guess it's all relative. There's some sort of fairly large mud flats, I guess, in China, but unfortunately, yeah, a lot of the larger mud flats have been destroyed and reclaimed. So, yeah, it's good to know that there's some still large mud flats around. And sorry, I've totally forgotten what your original question was.
Where's some great spots you've been?
Oh, where's some great spots? Yeah, well, I've been lucky enough to travel quite widely sort of around the world. There's some great places, depending whether you're talking from numbers or species diversity. I still think Broome is probably one of the better places from diversity, so a little bit biased because I live here, but I did come here because of that. But yeah, Philippines is some great spots there. China's really impressive, and so is Korea in the few remaining places that have that have been protected and not destroyed at this point in time. Russia, where I've been, and I've seen, you know, birds breeding there, shorebirds breeding there, and lots of youngsters, but you don't get the impressive flocks. So it really depends on what you're after to what might be a better site or not. But seeing, you know, birds on the breeding grounds, they're all spread out. They're you know, got their own little breeding territories. But, you know, seeing them breed, I think, is a very, very special thing to witness. And seeing the chicks, you know, just leaving the breeding grounds, or just about to leave the breeding grounds, knowing that they've had a successful year, it really means a lot.
I'll see if I can share this, share my screen with you and show you the photo I'm talking about. And maybe I'll use it as the picture for the podcast.
Sure.
And
then that's definitely China. Yeah. So that's in Bohai Bay, which is sort of near Beijing, I guess. And it's a reasonable size mudflat. It's a few kilometers. It's maybe 2 kilometers wide by, it's a bit sort of patchy, maybe 9-10 kilometers long. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, that's a really important site for a lot of shorebirds, particularly red knots, which is what I mainly go there to study. But unfortunately, yeah, that the pressure on that piece of coastline is just insane. You cannot go anywhere without seeing people or cars or boats, or, you know, the pollution levels are quite high. And yeah, it's just getting encroached on just from demand for land and development. And unfortunately, you know, the shorebirds are losing out.
Yeah, China's probably not the greatest place to stop off on the edge of some land if you're a little bird.
No, historically it's just had vast amounts of mudflat, and because of the major rivers coming into that bay and you know, lots of species have you know, specialized and adapted to those environments. You know, the spoon-billed sandpiper is a classic example, only found in that flyway. But yeah, as those habitats decline, you know, those specialist birds require specialist habitat, and you know, we're finding they've been declining, yeah, quite dramatically.
Mm, yeah. So you grew up whereabouts in SA did you grow up?
I was in Millicent in South Australia, not far from the Victorian border. A great spot for yeah, lots of birds there, and yeah, relatively good, you know, hot summers and wet winters, and really good for seabirds. We're very close to the continental shelf, and used to do quite a few pelagic trips looking at seabirds off the coast there. You know, during storms off the, you know, just sea watching off headlands and things, but particularly off boats. You know, if the weather was correct, that was a, you know, I used to love doing that. I do miss that a lot.
So you grew up in Millicent, then you moved to Broome, where you are currently. How did you make the jump from living in hot and humid Broome to working as a, I want to say a birding guide, but maybe an ornithological guide on cruises to the polar regions, the exact opposite sort of weather?
Yeah, it's very opposite, and I don't like the cold. I've got used to it now a bit. I used to like the heat, but I'm actually, you know, struggling this wet season. It's just so hot, and I like to say that it's worse than normal, but I don't think it is. I think it's just me getting soft and used to the cold conditions. But so I worked at the Broome Bird Observatory for several years, conducting tours and wildlife tours there. And my mate Chris, who I mentioned earlier, started up a tour company in Broome, and we would run wildlife tours in Broome, while the other one was on small expedition vessels off the Kimberley coast. And so it'd be roughly 2 weeks on the boat, you'd come back to Broome, and then we'd swap over, and the other one would do the land-based tours. And that's how we sort of got started. And there was a few staff on there that then moved to another company that doesn't exist anymore, but they started doing Kimberley coastlines, and their sort of portfolio of destinations expanded. And so I started working in sort of Alaska and northeast East Russia. And then from then on, you know, there's lots of other sort of boat companies, sort of the major sort of players, you know, end up doing some polar regions. And the company that I work for now is Quark Expeditions, and we just focus on polar regions. So our ships, we, you know, lease them out for the polar regions, and then some other company, you know, has them, you know, as they sail north or south depending on the time of year, and does tours, you know, in things like the Amazon and places like that. But we Quark doesn't touch that. We just specialize just in polar regions. So yeah, that's how I've sort of ended up, just through, you know, meeting contacts and you know, the general shift of, you know, tours. They spread out quite a lot around the globe once you're with one of the larger companies. Mm.
How are polar regions defined? Is there like a, you know, a definition of where the polar region actually is, you know, north or south?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess, you know, anything above the Arctic and Antarctic circles, clearly polar, but that's not really the polar region, you know, below that, or it's definitely well before that. There must be I can't think of the definition off the top of my head. Well, I guess it depends whether, you know, whether you're looking from a biological point of view or a political point of view. Like Antarctica, the biological boundary is very different to the political boundary as well. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm struggling for an exact definition.
Yeah, that's fine. Have you worked sort of equally Arctic and Antarctic, or are you more one or the other?
I've done it probably two more seasons in Antarctica than I have the Arctic, I guess. But now it's pretty much 50-50 now. I'm pretty much, well, if we take COVID out of the equation, that's normally what I'm doing. Obviously, this year's different, but pretty much 50-50, at least these days. It's roughly 4 months in both, probably.
Yeah. And what do you enjoy working about? What do you enjoy about working in those regions?
Oh, it's a really, really tough one. I think, you know, you don't get a lot of diversity. You get some amazing wildlife, which a lot of people don't get to see, and that's definitely a highlight. And birding in other areas of the world, you know, I do like to see new species I haven't seen before, but you just don't get that in Antarctica because it's such a specific habitat, and a lot of animals, you know, don't like that habitat. So it's just the challenges of it. I like seeing the smiles on people's faces, the first time they see icebergs, and you know, showing them orcas up close or humpback whales swimming under your zodiac, and or pointing out the different penguins. It is an amazing habitat where it's hard to explain if you've not been there, but it's just, you know, the nothingness, the scale of it, and the lack of human, you know, destruction, and it's just, you know, it's relatively pristine. I think that's just the things I like about it, but particularly the challenges. You know, the weather is so unpredictable. Even if you've got a good forecast, you know, it can change really quickly, and so it's not the same as doing some tours in some other parts of the world where it's like on Thursday we're going to be looking at, you know, this certain plant or animal, or, you know, this rock art or something like that. You know, it's always different in Antarctica. You got to be careful of the ice coming in and, you know, not being able to get to a landing site, or the weather picks up. It's never dull.
Mm. You were talking about zodiacs. So if anyone doesn't know, a zodiac is like a inflatable boat, I guess. Is that the way you describe it?
Yeah. Them? Yep. And there's various types of zodiacs. Yeah. As in sizes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was looking at some of your photos on Facebook, just trying to get an idea of what we could talk about on here. And obviously driving, being able to drive a zodiac is important, because you've got to dodge ice and seals and whales and whatever. One question I had, how do zodiac propellers deal with ice? I saw a photo of you going through what looked like a slushy, basically. Like, does ice cause issues for those motors?
Yeah, I'm lucky. I don't deal with the maintenance of the engines, which is good. We have a mechanic that deals with that. So it's just like, you know, I finish driving and sort of handball it to them, and you know, they handle it really well. I'm very surprised. Several years ago now, I was in a place near Ilulissat in Greenland, and the tide had changed, and there was this massive calving, and the amount of ice was absolutely phenomenal. Really hard to to try and get that across to yourself or yours. But it was taking me roughly half an hour, which would have taken probably 5 minutes, you know, when there was no ice, to get across to get the people. It was just thick, and you're just pushing, you know, as hard as you can through this ice, trying to separate it. And the propeller's just grinding these chunks of ice. But the propellers seem to be fine. It's when you hit rocks that seem to be the problem. You know, the ice has a bit of give in it. You know, it doesn't break up, but it pushes away in the water or pushes down. So it's certainly not good for the in general. But in that environment, like you're always driving through ice all the time. You just want to keep it slow and you know, bits get stuck underneath and you reverse and get rid of it. But it's not as bad as what you would think. But rocks are definitely, yeah, you hit a rock and it's bob our propeller for sure.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, I guess, is ice similar to rocks? But yeah, I guess if it moves,
yeah,
hit, that certainly helps. Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly hard like a rock, but it does move away and yeah, you would adjust your speed accordingly, of course, but you're definitely grinding a lot of ice. But it's, yeah, I've been very surprised how tough those propellers are, as long as you treat them with respect.
And so in a lot of your other photos of you working, you're carrying a rifle. Is that just for polar bears in the Arctic, or do you have other threats in Antarctica as well?
No,
and I assume you're not actually hunting polar bears. It's just for protection.
Yeah, it's good to clarify that. Yeah, no, the in Antarctica, no, there's no really any threats from sort of wildlife. You know, I think the biggest issue you have to be aware of is, you know, calving ice and the weather rapidly changing the situation. So it's very, very different in Antarctica. In the Arctic, we go to various places. So the Antarctica, most people, but not all, most companies visit the Antarctic Peninsula, which is below South America. But the Arctic's much broader. You've got parts of Alaska, you've got Canada. I spend a fair bit of time in Greenland and Svalbard, which is sort of well north of Norway. So you've got completely different habitats, different vegetation and different types of animals. And yeah, one of them, which, you know, is a keen thing to try and spot, is the polar bears. And they're not in all the spots we go, but definitely in places like Svalbard and Greenland and parts of Canada, they're definitely around. And one of the legal requirements for some of the places we visit is that you have to have the training and you have to carry a firearm. And in some of the places, it's a requirement also to have other control methods, which is what you would definitely want to use first. I mean, all the guides are as passionate as me, and the last thing you want to do is have to shoot a polar bear. So we look for them from the ship. You know, we know what sort of habitat that they're going to possibly be in or where they could be hiding. We go ashore before the guests do and search, do a big perimeter, making sure there's none, you know, sleeping and hiding behind rocks. It's, I think one thing people expect is, you know, big white polar bears, they're going to be easy to spot on the tundra, and that's not the case at all. It is insane how a polar bear can just blend in. They're actually easier to spot on the ice than what they are on the land. And so, yeah, we have these rifles, but, you know, we have flares, noise makers as well, to try and scare them off if we had to. I've never been in that situation again, because you're trying to look well in advance. The last thing you want is to get close to one, because they are a threat to people. So yeah, the rifle's sort of there as a last resort, but I mean, yeah, you don't want to use it. It's and you shouldn't need to if you've done all the right things beforehand, and as long as the people that you're with follow your instructions, it shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, it's amazing how well camouflaged things can be. I was looking yesterday, my wife and I were sort of semi-planning a holiday to Central Asia, and I was looking at ibis bills, and one of the things was they're very well camouflaged in the rocks, and I was like, oh, I don't know, that's a pretty big bird, and it's, you know, it's fairly obvious. And then I was looking at a photo that had one in it, and I could not find it, and when you could see it, it was blatantly obvious. But it's amazing how things that don't look like they should be able to camouflage themselves just seem to somehow, like polar bears, for example.
Yeah, ibis bills are amazing. I've seen them in the mountains north of Beijing, and they certainly do blend into those stony riverbeds.
Yeah. So we should talk a little bit about birds. That's what people are here to listen about. So what are the main birds? I mean, you've got penguins, you've got all sorts of ocean birds, but you know, what would the top, well, I don't know, three, four different species be in Antarctica and maybe in the Arctic, if you can think off the top of your head?
Bird wise.
Look,
I'd have to say in Antarctica, the emperor penguin is probably one of my highlights. But however, worth pointing out though is that a lot of people just think that they're common and spread out around the whole of Antarctica, and that's not the case. In fact, the northern parts of the peninsula where most boats go, you know, it is a lot warmer. They love thick amounts of ice, and they have a different breeding cycle. So although you go to the peninsula and you see, you know, large colonies of Adelies, Gentoos and Chinstrap penguins, you know, you don't have the colonies of emperors because they're a winter nester. They nest out on the fast ice, the sea ice that's attached to the mainland. So in summer, that's all melted. So people, which sort of baffles me a bit, people, you know, not doing some research before they go to, you know, sort of understand what they might see. But, you know, we still get people going, oh, when will we visit an emperor penguin colony? And like, well, we could visit one now if you wanted, but it would just be open water. Like, they're not going to be there. So I think the emperor penguin, yeah, probably a highlight for me, but not easily seen. There are some specific tours, which you need, generally, you need a big icebreaker and even helicopters to get to their colony. And look, you do see the odd one. You know, I have seen them on the peninsula. You can get stragglers, and there's definitely a handful seen each season on the peninsula, but you certainly wouldn't go down there expecting to see one. But I think the large colonies of those other penguin species, Gentoo, Adelies and Chinstraps that I mentioned, are very impressive. The noise, the smell, and sitting back and just watching what goes on, you know, the fighting between the penguins and their territories. You've got brown and south polar skuas coming in and trying to steal the eggs or steal the chicks. And that's pretty impressive. Not a bird, but leopard seals, they're chasing the penguins. They're a big threat as well. On land, they're fine, but in the water, they're amazingly fast and, often are taking out penguins. They need to feed as well, and particularly towards the end of the summer when the babies are just starting to learn to swim. They're particularly vulnerable. And then the getting there's various ways of getting to Antarctica. Most people do go by ship, and I totally recommend going by ship, but part of the experience and just seeing the vast numbers of albatross and petrels on the way down is certainly a highlight. And if you're not seasick, then you know, just spend as much time as you can outside on the bridge or on the outer decks looking for all the wildlife.
Do you have a list of the birds that you've seen on your Antarctic trips?
Yeah, I wouldn't know, depending what you're asking, I wouldn't know off the top of my head what that is at the moment, but I keep a list for everyone. You know, for a trip list from what we see, so a daily list that we have that everyone's able to get if they go on the voyages. I think most companies do that, but I also do eBird records. So I submit all my sightings to eBird, a global citizen science database. Yeah,
yeah. I was just going to ask roughly how many birds or how many species might you expect to see on a trip? I imagine it wouldn't be much, like you said previously, but if you had any sort of idea.
I guess, yeah, 30-ish maybe. Again, it depends whether you know, what the weather's like and whether you're outside when you're sailing down the Beagle Channel, which is when you leave Ushuaia. You know, there's often, you know, geese and oyster catchers and ducks and things like that, and that definitely changes things, and you also get some different cormorants. But, you know, really you're only going to get sort of 3, maybe 4 penguins when you're down there. You know, quite a few albatross and petrels on the way, depending on the weather. Obviously, the rougher the weather, the better it is for those. A lot of people hope for calm weather, but, you know, if you want calm weather and birds, you're not going to necessarily get that. I reckon off the top of my head, it'd be sort of 20 to 30. It's certainly not a, you know, a, huge variety, but just all the birds that are there are pretty special.
Yeah, and I suppose most people wouldn't be sort of twitchers. They wouldn't be there just to find birds. They would be there for the whole experience.
Yeah, that's what we find. Most people are just generally interested in Antarctica and just wanted to see it. They're not necessarily hardcore bird watchers. Generally, the hardcore ones would, you know, try and book on a tour that specifically goes to an emperor penguin colony, because, you know, going to Antarctica is not cheap, and if you're only going to do it once, it's the only chance you've got of getting an emperor penguin. So if you are sort of keen, then that's, you know, you want to book on a trip that sort of has a greater chance of encountering that species. And when you do go deeper into the ice, you have a greater chance of seeing things like snow petrels and Antarctic petrels, as well as you get a bit deeper into it. And yeah. South Georgia is another place which is an amazing island just to the east of South America. And it's an amazing sight there. You do get a pipit, the most southerly songbird. You've got some South Georgian pintail, and lots of the albatross and petrels breed there, as well as a few other species like large numbers of macaroni and king penguins.
My last question about Antarctica, and I don't know if this is Antarctica or the Arctic, another one of your Facebook photos, which I'll share with you so you can see it. This, I was just having a look through. Now, in this photo, which is you landing a Zodiac on land with snow-covered hills in the background and icebergs and everything, the water is clear enough that you can see what looks to me like seagrass. Now, I would not expect seagrass to be growing in a polar region, but am I looking at that right?
Yeah, you are. So there's lots of bits of... It does depend where you are, and certainly in the northern parts of the peninsula you get more of it, but there's like, you know, algae growth, and I wouldn't really... There's sort of... It's like kelp, but it's not like the big... true, you know, sort of bull kelp that most people are visualizing. So you get that more in the sub-Antarctic places like South Georgia. It's ridiculously common. And you do get it washed up in the South Shetland sometimes. It's been dislodged from, you know, far away. So there is algal growth and little bits of seaweed and stuff, but nothing on a massive scale. And it gets pretty destroyed in patches where those icebergs, you know, run aground and grind along the bottoms, sort of clear it off a bit. But there certainly is. You mentioned about the water, how clear it is, and I think that's there's lots of differences between Antarctica and the Arctic, but the clarity of the water is much clearer in Antarctica. And one of the main reasons for that is, and you can see in the photograph just how much snow and ice there is, whereas in the Arctic, in most places, you've got, you know, lots and lots of rock and soil and vast amounts of vegetation, and you've generally got these specific glacier faces or fronts that you can sort of defined and easily named and things. And so you have lots of soil and vegetation getting washed into the ocean, and that is lots of sediment in there, and so it does make it quite murky, but you're just not getting that sediment runoff in Antarctica, and the clarity is amazing, which is, if you've got a GoPro, or if you haven't got a GoPro and you think you're going down there, I recommend bringing a GoPro. It's amazing looking at the bottom of icebergs. Often you might have seals or whales around your Zodiac, and like you said, you can see what's on the bottom of the floor, like you can see in that image when you're coming in closer to a landing site.
And talking about icebergs decimating what's on the bottom, do they know whether that iceberg that's headed for South Georgia is going to hit ground there or not yet?
No, not that I've heard. I haven't been following it the last few weeks. I've seen that iceberg twice. So I saw that. I'm getting lost now. What are we with 2020? So I saw that in the 2019-2020 summer when it was in the sort of northern parts of the Weddell Sea. And the year before that, I saw it when it was much further south, when I went to a specific emperor penguin colony on an icebreaker. We could see it in the distance. But, last year it has sort of popped out into the open ocean a bit more, and we could, you know, take the big ship up to it. But it was just it's amazing size. You just can't, the scale of it's just phenomenal. But Yeah, I don't know. There was some models. It looks like it's just sort of going to plow into the western side, but I think the models were predicting it's probably going to go around the bottom and possibly get caught on the eastern side. I think that I was looking at, and that's where a lot of the wildlife is. Yeah, look, it's hard to say where it gets stuck. It's going to have a fairly big draft on it, and the continental shelf does sort of stick out quite a way. So hopefully it does sort of get stuck well beforehand. But whether it's going to have a huge impact or not, it really depends where and it gets stuck, how long it gets stuck there. But, you know, it might be a negative for some things, but it's certainly going to be a boom for others. The amount of nutrients and the amount of krill that will be around that iceberg will be phenomenal. It'll be an amazing place to go for looking for whales, like blue whales and southern right whales as well. They love those icebergs. So, you know, it may have an impact, but it's certainly going to benefit a lot of other things. And long term, I'm sure, you know, king penguins actually rapidly expanding are going to benefit in the long run.
Have you birded South Georgia? What's the bird life sort of? Is it similar to Antarctica?
No, very different to Antarctica. It's got penguins, but it's got large amounts of vegetation like tussocks and stuff. So it's not easy walking. The centre has got a lot of glacial covered mountains. There's lots of glaciers there, but there's certainly, you know, vast amounts of vegetation and hundreds of thousands of king penguins in colonies and lots of skuas, and it's lots of fur seals as well. So you get fur seals, they breed in places like South Georgia in the summer, and then they leave once they've finished breeding and head to the peninsula. So we often don't get large amounts of fur seals on the peninsula till later, so like February, March generally, whereas they're in their millions, and they are a bit of a problem. They're quite aggressive, and if anyone has been there that's listening, they'll be flashing back to the memories of getting chased possibly by by fur seals. They're like little rottweilers on steroids, I think.
Well, I think we're about out of time. We've been going for nearly 40 minutes already. But I do have one question that I ask everybody who comes on the show. So before we finish, out of everywhere that you've been birding, and I'll take this back to the Australian mainland so that it's useful to people. Of everywhere you've been birding, where is one place that you would recommend everybody should go at least once? And I assume you're going to say something like Roebuck Bay, but I'll ask anyway.
Oh, can I say three?
Yeah, say as many as you like. Yep.
I think Roebuck Bay is, you know, definitely a place that someone should go, particularly if they're keen on shorebirds or want to learn about shorebirds. You know, good numbers, lots of diversity, it's good weather, and I highly recommend that. But for me, of course, because I live here, I think one region that I love is the Cairns area. I think you've got, you know, Atherton Tablelands, you've got lush rainforest, you've got the Barrier Reef, you've got mudflats, you've got mangroves, you've got dry woodland, you've just got so many habitats there, and I really love the Cairns region. And then from a twitching sort of point of view, from a sort of rare bird and unusual bird place, it would have to be Ashmore Reef, which is part of the Australian territory. It's technically on the continental shelf, but it's only roughly 100 kilometres south of Indonesia. So you get these rare birds blow across from Indonesia onto these islands. But it's just a haven for vast amounts of seabirds, lots of boobies and frigate birds and terns and noddies. And then amongst the trees that are still there is where you can get some unusual birds that are not seen on other places in Australia, and just walking around that island, you just never know what the next bush could hold, and that sort of creates a level of excitement which you don't really get in other parts of Australia.
Mm. Yeah, sweet. There's a few there for people to chase up. Well, thanks for giving us 45 minutes of your time, and hopefully COVID will nick off at some point, and you can get back to work, and I can get some more overseas people to come in and give me some more work, and we'll all be good. But appreciate chatting to you, and might see you around in the field sometime.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let's hope we get back to our normal work soon.
So thanks everybody for listening. Hope you found that interesting. I would personally love to get to Antarctica one day, or the Arctic, or really anywhere in general that I haven't been before. I hope you all have a fantastic Christmas and a great New Year and everything in between that. And hopefully 2021 will shape up to be a much better year. And until then, happy birding.